Today is Friday, June 15th, 2018. I'm Sarah Lang with the Oral History Program at UW-Madison. I'm talking with Jim Lee, book artist, UW alum, and founder of Blue Moon Press. I'm at the University Archives and Steenbach Library, and Jim is in Connecticut. Jim, can you talk about growing up in Kansas and what that was like?
Sure. I grew up in Wichita, Kansas. Sort of dead center in the country. We have a fairly conventional sort of middle-class suburban background. My father was a aeronautical engineer with Boeing for almost the whole period that I was growing up in the late 50s and early 1960s. My mother was a housewife. I have a older sister who's 8 years older than I am, and although we're close, it's not like having a sibling that was near my age, so I was kind of on my own a lot and kind of left to my own devices of entertaining myself. I in terms of the art world, we had very little art going on in our house, no real art per se on the walls, family photos, things like that. Wichita, Kansas was not exactly the hotbed of the visual art world, especially then. But I somehow gotten involved in taking some art lessons with a older lady in her basement for a couple of years. That usually involved flipping through magazines and finding images that I would want to draw from, and then sort of copying those images. It was not anything very intense at all, and I only did it for a couple of years in probably my late grade school, elementary school days. Other than that, I didn't really have any kind of art background other than taking art classes and school. And as I got older, in the 1960s sort of progressed, I got more interested in music and played the guitar, and I was interested in typical sort of 1960s era counterculture, Peter Max, art, the Beatles, Bob Dylan, people like that. Those were the influential things that helped form me during my early adolescence. I began to see some pop art in the early 70s, people like Jim Dine and, of course, Andy Warhol. And those were big influences, I suppose, just in the kind of celebrity status of art making. But that was pretty much my beginnings of kind of looking at art. One thing that sort of did happen though, and as I look back on it, I find it more important than it was at the time, was somehow I found myself at the Wichita Art Museum, which is a fairly good little art museum. And I remember a painting by Ben Shahn called The Blind Botanist, which had a kind of an expressionist, satirical kind of look that I really responded to. And I also saw watercolor by Charles Birchfield called Winter Moonlight. It's kind of a landscape of a moon over some kind of strange, mysterious looking trees. And both of them had a fairly strong narrative and expressionist kind of flavor with distortions of form. And I didn't understand them, and I had no real context for them, but they had made an impression on me as an early teenager. In high school, I took art classes, and didn't really seem to be able to do much else. Wasn't very good and interested in academics, and so I spent as much time as I could in the art room. My art teacher was a Japanese-American woman named Annie Lowry, and she encouraged me to sort of dive deeper into visual art. And I hung out with several other art students, and we were sort of the art crowd at the time in the high school. There was one other kind of seminal thing, I think, that took place in high school. We took a bus trip. It was actually a science-related bus trip, but we stopped in this little town called Lindsborg, Kansas, and it was sort of a side trip on the main trip, and we stopped at this little school called Bethany College, and we went into the Berger San Zane Memorial Gallery, and it just seemed like a really nice place, and I was kind of thinking about possibly going to college for art and really look at any other schools, and when I was at that day at Bethany, it sort of made an impression on me, and my art teacher encouraged me to go there, and that's kind of how I wound up there.
And how old were you when you visited Bethany College?
Well, I was probably either a junior in high school or maybe the first semester senior year. It was just about the time that you start thinking about going to college, and I didn't really, I had sort of decided that maybe that would be what I would do, but I hadn't really done any research or looked around at all, and this little trip sort of accidentally put me there, was the reason I wound up going to Bethany.
And what classes did you take in high school? What kinds of art classes? Did you do any printmaking, for example?
I did actually do a little tiny bit of silkscreen printing in high school. They would do posters for the theatrical productions at the high school, and sometimes I would help out making these posters, and I remember cleaning the screens a lot more than doing anything else. Other than that, you know, I probably was taught some relief printing. I don't really remember doing it, but it was mostly a drawing and painting kind of courses that I took. You know, I don't know that there was much art history or anything. It was just sort of come to the art room, kind of hang out and do some stuff, and that's sort of how it kind of worked for me. It was just a place that I felt comfortable compared to some more academic kind of pursuits that I would be asked to do in other classes.
Sure. And then how did you prepare for applying to Bethany College? Did you get any help from your teachers or your family?
Probably my teacher gave me some advice about it. I don't really remember too much about it. My folks had no idea about what any of this was about. You know, going to college was just something you did after high school, but art was not on their radar screen, so they were very accommodating, and I kind of, I mean, looking back on it, I'm kind of amazed that they let me go with so little research into it and so little prospects related to it. But they seemed to think if I was interested in it, that would be okay. And so even though they didn't understand it, they let me go, and that was the only school I applied to. I didn't apply to any other schools, and they seemed to think that was okay too, and that's how I wound up there.
And what was Bethany College like when you got there?
Well, Bethany is in this little, this cute little Swedish immigrant community in central Kansas. It's kind of a tourist destination, and there has several art galleries, or had several art galleries in town, and quite a number of gift shops for people that would come to town and like the sort of Swedish gift products. Lots of orange dollar horses. Everybody had a dollar horse on their front door as their address, sort of marker.
Can you describe? Can you describe what those horses are?
A dollar horse?
Yes.
Well, dollar is a particular part of Sweden, apparently. And it's a kind of a a dollar horse is a kind of a silhouette shape of the horse. They're almost always painted bright orange with a little bit of sort of floral kind of toll painting on them too. They were very, you just would see them everywhere in town. It was sort of the motto, the mascot of the town.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And Bethany is a small four-year liberal arts college. Has a fairly strong music and art background. A lot of education majors would go there, and especially art education majors. They only had four faculty members in art when I was there, so and they did a lot of, everybody taught art history, and there was a ceramicist and a painter and a sculptor and a photographer who also taught drawing. And the majority of the people that went there in the art program were art history or art education or education majors. And everybody had to take a printmaking course that's just part of the general curriculum. It was kind of a combination relief and intaglio class, printmaking one, and you know everybody took it, and most people just didn't like it and went right back to the ceramic studio. But I kind of liked how it worked. I liked the kind of mechanics of printmaking and the idea of being able to break it down into a series of very specific jobs that added up to a print. I like the idea of multiples, having an addition, and the whole thing sort of made sense to me. The other thing about that course was that the print shop was almost always empty, because everybody else would be hanging out down in the ceramic studio or maybe in the painting studio. So I could sort of camp out in there and had the place more or less to myself. Another student that was there at the time was a guy named Ray Troll, and he and I were pretty good friends. We were basically the two printmakers, and I was the first printmaker to graduate there in like with a printmaking concentration in like 10 years. It just was not on anybody else's radar screen. But Ray and I would hang out in there, and we sort of had our own little thing going in printmaking, and that seemed to be different than what everybody else was doing. And that's partly why I think I got into it, is that it was not being done by everybody else.
And can you talk a little bit about your teacher for printmaking there?
The faculty member who taught printmaking is named Bob Bosco. And Bob was primarily a painter, somewhat of a photographer, too. He taught printmaking, I think, mostly because it was required of him to teach it.
Mm-hmm.
He did a good job, and he certainly instilled in me the kind of an interest in it. But it was not his primary studio practice. He was mostly a painter, and his work varied quite a bit over the 4 years that I was there. So I think that there was a certain amount of just sort of getting through teaching those classes for him, but it was not his something that he was super excited about, maybe. But like I say, whatever he did, it certainly instilled in me a certain interest in the process that's where I got it. It was from Bob.
And what did he think of your interest and concentration on printmaking?
What did he think about it?
Yeah, did he ever say anything to you about, like, because you're doing something different from other students?
Well, I think that he appreciated that, you know, he had this little two-person cadre of printmakers that were more interested in it than anybody else. And so, you know, looking back on it, I probably thought I was pretty hot stuff. I wasn't one of these people that were just there to learn how to do art education and go off and teach art. I was, you know, a real artist who made important art, I thought. And so I think that he also kind of thought that, well, these two guys are kind of interesting, and they're doing things that are a little bit different than the majority of what the students were doing. And so he seemed to really encourage us, and we hung around outside of class time too quite a bit, and he was an early mentor for me that certainly made an impact on me at the time.
And how did you decide to go on from there and get your master's and go to UW-Madison?
Well, after I graduated, I hung around in Lindsborg for another couple of years. I lived in a kind of a really low-rent apartment up above the hardware store. And I had a studio in a kind of a cement block building on the alley behind the bakery that they laughingly called the garden apartment. I made screen prints. I built my own equipment and had a fairly productive couple of years making screen prints. In that studio. I also helped run a co-op gallery in town that I showed in, and we had a couple shows in there, and I had some shows other places in the area. And then I also worked full-time for a four-color cattle publishing magazine, publishing company that printed a magazine called the Simmental Shield. And the Simmental is a large breed of Swiss cattle, kind of almost a boutique kind of imported kind of cattle. And so I did paste up and layout work for them. Every day, full time, and I would do. I'd also draw pictures of bulls and pigs and stuff that would show up in these magazines. I also worked part time for a while at the Berger San Zane Museum on campus as a janitor. So I was just hanging out in town there and working, trying to sort of build a portfolio of work up. And I started thinking that I probably should go to graduate school. I had no idea where to go. I got very little kind of input from people at the school about that kind of thing. But I did talk to a visiting artist that came there after I had graduated, but while I was still in town. I went and heard his lecture. And I talked to him a little bit afterwards, and he kind of mentioned that Madison, University of Wisconsin in Madison, was a strong printmaking school. But more than that, I happened on a copy of Art News magazine, probably in 1976 or 77, that had an image of a color etching by Warrington Colescott on the cover. Mm-hmm. And an article about a printmaking exhibition he was in of contemporary print artists at the Brooklyn Museum. The image on the cover was from his History of Printmaking series, and it was a print of William Stanley Hayter inventing viscosity printing. And I was really taken with it. I loved the narrative and expression of style, and I thought to myself, this is what I want to do. The article mentioned that he taught at UW-Madison. And so I applied there, along with a few other Midwest universities, to the MFA program.
And can you talk a little bit about finding out that you got in?
Well, yeah, I put together work that I'd been doing in my little cement block sheds of a studio. I've been working on kind of a series of prints and drawings that had a kind of a figure that wore a mask with a really long, pointy nose, sort of a punch clown figure.
Mm-hmm.
And he would cavort around in the moonlight and rode a dog through the sky. It was this whole sort of little personal mythological thing that I started to invent. The prints I made were mostly screen prints, and I would often approach the process by laying down some flat colors through paper stencils. And then I would do a photo screen over the top that I would make by drawing with a grease pencil on some acetate and then scratching back through that. So the final run was that was printed over the top had this kind of scratched, carved look. It looked a lot like relief prints,
mm-hmm.
wood cuts or linoleum cuts. And that was a lot of what I had in my portfolio that I applied to school with. When I heard back from Madison, I was real excited, and I heard from several other schools. And so in 77, maybe, I took a trip and drove around going to look at different schools, and I had an old Datsun pickup truck,
mm-hmm.
and I would sleep in the back of the truck at night as I would check out different schools. And when I came into Madison, I was dazzled by the school and the town. There was just so much energy going on there, and there were so many students everywhere I looked. There was so much going on, and it was so different than any place else I had visited. And pretty quickly after I pulled into town, and then I went to the art department, I pretty much made up my mind, this is where I'm going to go. I met Ray Gleckler, who taught relief print there.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray had been one of the people who had voted for accepting me based on my application. And I came to find out later on that the screen prints that I had included in my portfolio, he thought were relief prints. And so that maybe I got in by mistake. Ray toured me around, and I really enjoyed talking with him, and it all sort of added up to this is the place that I should go.
Did you get a chance to talk to any of the current students in the program while you were visiting?
I think I did. Can't quite remember now, but mm-hmm. I saw a lot going on. I saw all the facilities. There were just so many print studios all lined up down the hall, and there's such great facilities. And there seemed to be just so much energy going on there. So many print students. At the time, there were, I have no idea how many grad students in printmaking were there, but it just seemed like there were tons. And on this trip at Madison, it was the first time I'd saw any kind of book arts. I had no experience with book arts at all prior to this. I didn't know anything about it. I had no idea that regular people could make books. I thought books came from factories.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was there, though, I saw these books, student books, in showcases in the hallway and was struck by how interesting they were and how they just looked like totally different than anything else I'd ever seen. And so that was my first exposure to book arts.
And when you started school then, what kinds of classes did you start out taking?
Well, my first year at UW, Warren Colescott, who, you know, was the main reason I wanted to go there, was on sabbatical.
Okay.
Things always worked out that way. So I took relief prints with Ray Delacour, which I probably would have anyway, but I took etching with Warrington's replacement, David Becker, from Detroit. He's a wonderful etcher, kind of a very totally different stylistically than Warrington. Very intense, kind of moody, surrealist, kind of figurative work. And I took litho with Jack Deamer. Mm-hmm. I'd never done litho before because Bethany College didn't have any litho. And so I took that first semester, I took litho with Jack. I didn't really get that much out of litho. I didn't really like it all that well. It seemed a little reproductive to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I made one litho that I really liked. I rolled up a litho stone, just flat black, and processed it. And then I scratched an image back into it with a stylus.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like making a relief print. And I really liked the print, and I submitted it to Boston Printmakers North American Juried Exhibition and won an award of some paper from the Strathmore Paper Company. And that was a kind of a strong, interesting thing that happened that year. Even though I didn't continue doing any litho, that one print sort of seemed to have some impact on things. My wife and I got married in 1978, and we moved to Madison for me to go to school, and we lived in an apartment on Washington Street, just up from the old train station. And I would bike to work every day, or to school every day. And my wife worked at a health cooperative in town. And so I'd be down to school all day and then come home and usually go back in the evening. And, you know, there were so many really strong print students there. There was a lot of competition, and I sort of felt like I had to step up my game and push myself to sort of even get noticed. In the second semester of my first year, I took a papermaking class with Walter Hamady.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time I'd dealt with Walter. And I was not all that excited about the process. Once I learned how to make paper, it sort of felt a little like just a sort of a craft thing,
mm-hmm.
partly because I didn't really have, the paper I was making didn't really work for the prints I was making, so I didn't really have a use for it. So I just sort of felt like I was just going through the motions making this paper. But, like I said, it's my first exposure to Walter, and he certainly made a strong impression on me with his personality and his presence.
Can you talk a little bit?
Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I was just going to ask you if you could talk a little bit more about that.
About Walter or about
paper? Yeah, what you mean by his presence impressed you and that kind of thing. Like,
well,
what was he like in class?
Walter is just an amazing, mercurial, strong person, strong presence. His sense of who he is and what he does just sort of radiates out from him, and it's pretty hard to not be influenced by him. He likes to talk. He likes to talk about himself. He likes to talk about the things that he's interested in. And his teaching style is pretty much just this kind of running monologue of the things that he's interested in and what he thinks we should be, students should be interested in. And just sort of sitting there listening to him talk about his world and his family. At the time, he had two young twins and an older, slightly older daughter, and we learned all about everything that was going on in his family, and everything that was going on down at the farm where his press and his paper mill was, and projects that he was involved in, the people who he was collaborating with. He was constantly discussing different writers and different pipe designers, and people he was he had connections with. They just sort of seemed to build a whole world, for me anyway, that was totally new to me, but something that I knew I really wanted to be involved in. And even though this papermaking class didn't really click that much, and it was mostly just because, like I said, I didn't really have a use for the paper. It just seemed like I was just sort of going through the motions. Walter certainly made an important impact on me. I continued to make wood and linoleum cuts with Roy Gleckler and make some etchings, but I sort of hadn't really gotten into any kind of a groove as a grad student yet. However, I met another grad student early on who had a studio in the same building I did. I was in the University Avenue studio. It was like a storefront sort of studio. I'm not sure if it's even there anymore. There were a number of us in this building, and this particular guy, John Bennett, he'd done his undergraduate work at UW. He'd worked with Ray Gleckler, mm-hmm. and had worked with Walter Hamady. And he made books. He'd now moved into the graduate program. He'd been making books with Walter and wood engravings with Ray Gleckler. He had his own Vandercook proofing press in his studio, and he had type in there. And I watched him as he made books under his press name, which was Gardilou Press.
Mm-hmm. And did you end up using his press at all? I know sometimes students would use other presses, or sometimes they would just use the ones in the classroom.
Well, at the time, I still hadn't made any kind of books. I was still just doing single sheet prints, and I was using the equipment in the main building. But in that second, probably 79, probably the second semester of my first year there, John Bennett commissioned me to do a book of linoleum cuts in collaboration with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was his book, but it was my imagery. This was called In the Apartment. And I designed and cut the images, and I wrote short dialogue captions that would go under the prints. And John set the type and did the printing, and helped with the printing. And we actually used the paper from this Strathmore Paper Award
won
the previous semester for the bulk of the edition. And it was perfect. The book format was perfect for the sort of narrative approach to imagery that I was making. And from that time on, I was hooked on the book format.
So then, did you take some bookmaking classes?
Yeah, in my second year, I started working with Hamady and his typography classes. And I made letterpress broadsides and books. Walter's first project was a folded broadside, and I made a broadside about my dog and all the various brushes with death. And then later in the semester, I produced my first book, my own, and it's called The Illustrated Goose, and it was kind of a warped series of nursery rhymes with histories about each of the nursery rhymes. They were linoleum, color linoleum cuts, and my work had a tendency to look a little bit different than most of the other tech students. Walter's influence on people was so strong that a lot of this other students' work had a kind of a Hamady look.
Okay.
And my stuff didn't. it just sort of looked different. I think it was because of my sort of printmaking background, and sort of I kind of backed into the whole affair. And so the format made perfect sense to me, to be able to hook together a bunch of narrative images in one object and have this kind of sequential relationship of one image to the next. But it was mostly sort of image based rather than text based. My texts were sort of minimal, and I'm not what I consider to be a masterful typographer. But the use of letterpress certainly was something that I found interesting and enjoyed doing, and loved the letterpress quality of how type bites into the paper, and setting the type by hand, and handling the type and moving it around. You know, I got into all of that kind of stuff. But it was always at the service of some kind of pictorial image, rather than coming at it from a sort of a text and then maybe adding an image or two. The images were the major thing.
And how did you come up with the concept for Illustrated Goose?
Could you say that again?
How did you come up with the concept for the Illustrated Goose?
Oh, the concept. Well, I don't know. I'm trying to remember now. I was looking around for something that had sort of, it was kind of a series, something that I could, I wouldn't have to work with an author on, or find somebody to write something, I could build myself. And I guess I've been looking at nursery rhymes. I've always liked that kind of thing, folklore, mythology, and nursery rhymes kind of fall into that category. And so I think I'd probably been looking at various nursery rhyme books at the time and decided, you know, I think I can take off on this and find my own version of it. So I remember going to the Memorial Library and spending a bunch of time looking at nursery rhyme books and histories of nursery rhymes at the time. And so I selected some things that made some visual imagery for me in my brain, and sort of played with that, made these linoleum cuts, and then countered that with the nursery rhyme, but then a little history of how that, some of what's behind the particular nursery rhyme.
Yeah, I think it was a really interesting approach to the stories. What about, I guess, you would have had a final show, right, as part of your MFA program. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. In the next semester, I was working with Walter Amity, and I printed another book. It's called The Seven Deadly Sins, which again was a linoleum cut book that had a sin per page spread. It had all kinds of fold outs and fold ups, and it was kind of a similar thing to what I had done with the Illustrated Goose. And I'd been making some single sheet prints. Warren Tucholsky had come back from sabbatical, and I worked with him in etching and made some color etchings and got involved in multiple plate etchings and doing a lot of selective wiping. But I had already been sort of seduced into the book arts at that point, so my single sheet print production kind of fell off quite a bit because I was putting so many images into each of these books. So by the time my MFA show rolled around, I had mostly books to show, and I sort of spread them out in mats on the wall, in addition to the actual books, so people could see beyond just the opening spread of a particular book. And I had some drawings and some single sheet prints as well. My work had pretty much coalesced into sort of a somewhat satirical kind of narrative style, very much coming out of sort of German expressionism.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of slight distortion of figure and very compressed kinds of compositions where things were sort of packed into really small spaces. And that came through quite a bit in the work that I had in my MFA show. And so it was mostly, like I said, it's mostly books with a few, with some other single sheet prints.
Do you remember how many books you made while you were here?
Really, just those two.
Okay.
Like I said, I came into it in my second year.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just those two that I did while I was at Madison.
And can you talk a little bit more about how you came up with the idea for Seven Deadly Sins?
Well, again, I think I was sort of shopping around for something that didn't require working with some author. A lot of the other book students they either knew people who wrote poetry, or they shopped around and found authors who would work with them. I just didn't seem to operate in that way. I guess I didn't have as much literary kind of bend as a lot of the other students did.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tended to look for something that had a kind of a more pictorial base that would, and something that seemed to have its own kind of set of conditions, like the Seven Deadly Sins, something that was already sort of a known quantity that I could then kind of riff on in my own way. And so I think sin is always a lot more interesting than virtue. I mean, most people will find it a little more interesting, so there's places to go with it, you know. And so the images were pretty satirical, and I used the format of the book structure a little bit more in that production. When I got to Gluttony, the format size needed to expand beyond the footprint of the book, so it folds up and it folds out into this sort of really large gluttonous sort of figure. And then there's all kinds of sort of disgusting food that he's sort of sitting on. In fact, that I'm thinking about it, that book, that section of the book has its own, has a fold-out that goes the other direction, too. So there's actually two images associated with gluttony. Gluttony sort of seemed to be the epitome of sin. It's like excess, more and more and more. And I did... write an introduction for that book. Actually, I think I probably wrote one for Illustrated Goose, too, but I wrote an introduction for Seven Deadly Sins in the guise of a kind of a sort of Bible-thumping preacher.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about sin and how prevalent it is in everybody's life. And satirical.
And how did your fellow students react to your satirical books, since they were so different from what they were doing, perhaps?
Well, it seemed to go over pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a really choice group of people the couple of years that I was at Madison. The cover paper was handmade by Kathy Keene, a really important, who has gone on to become an important printmaker and printer and book artist in her own right. She was Walter's shop assistant at the time. Walter Tisdale was one of my classmates, good friends. Barbara Tettenbaum was another one in that class. Jim Escalante, who went on to teach at UW for a long time, was in that group. Sheila Webb and Rick Zoft and Chuck Alexander. It was a really good group of type and book arts people that I found myself amongst. And, you know, there was a lot of competition and, you know, healthy competition amongst us all. And we kind of helped each other out with printing, and we were a real cohesive group that happened to be there at that particular time that I think certainly for me was seminal in my the formation of my career as an artist.
I know you've continued to work with some of them too after you left Madison. Could you talk a little bit about Blue Moon Press, how you came up with that name?
Yeah, I remember it pretty clearly. I was late at night working in the paper mill, was making paper for, I think it was making paper for the In the Apartment book that I did with John Bennett. The end sheets were handmade. The book was hardcover cased in, but we had this kind of handmade paper that I printed some tulip wallpaper pattern on, and I was probably making that really late at night. And I remember sitting in the doorway of the old Johnson Street paper mill, like it was in the basement, pretty grim facility at the time, but it was very serviceable, and we all used it. And I remember sitting there looking while the pulp was beating in the auger beater, sitting in the doorway looking out into the night, and it was a full moon at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We were kind of encouraged to come up with a press name. I don't know if it wasn't something that was mandatory or anything, but we all sort of felt like that was something that we should do, that sort of create this kind of identity as printers and as book artists. And so I was looking at the full moon, and I thought Blue Moon Press would capture the idea of something rare or uncommon, and it had a certain kind of mysterious sound.
Mm-hmm.
I also always liked the old song Blue Moon by the Marcells.
Okay.
And the old country song Blue Moon of Kentucky, Keep on Shining.
Mm-hmm.
Both those songs that things I remember from the time. And so I thought, well, that sounds like this might be a good name for me. And it seemed to sum up how I approached my book work, kind of once, seeing something finished every once in a blue moon. And it's been a good description of my work ever since.
Would you like to stop here, or would you like to continue on?
Well, I think that, you know, on your list, that's kind of where we sort of said we'd stop.
So yeah.
Good place to stop.
Okay, thank you. Today is Friday, June 22nd, 2018. I'm Sarah Lang with the Oral History Program at UW-Madison. I'm talking with Jim Lee, book artist, UW alum, and founder of Blue Moon Press. I'm at the University Archives and Steinbach Library, and Jim is in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Jim, last time we were talking about your time at the UW, and this time I know we wanted to kind of start with you moving away from Madison. And I know that your first stop was in Manitoba. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. When I was at UW, I met a couple of people who were there. One was Diane Thornycroft, who is a Canadian, and she was taking a degree at university doing printmaking. And her husband, Bill Pura, was along with her. He wasn't enrolled, but he was on sabbatical. He taught at University of Manitoba, and he had come along too. And I met them both, and about the time I finished up, they were finishing up too, and it just, there happened to be a a job opening in printmaking as a sabbatical replacement, and a part-time kind of position first that had then turned into a sabbatical replacement at the University of Manitoba, and they asked me if I was interested in applying, and I said, oh, you bet. So I went up and interviewed and got the job, and that was probably the, one of the reasons why I left UW after 2 years, because I had this job that came up. And so my wife and I drove up there with all our belongings, and amazingly, somehow there was a glitch with the immigration business, so that I didn't have the right papers when I got to, and so we had to wait for 2 weeks, and it was kind of a, you know, kind of a weird snafu as we were leaving town. And so eventually the people from Manitoba called down and said, okay, we got everything straightened out, so now you can come up. And so we were driving up through the wilds of North Dakota towards the border, hoping there was the immigration papers sitting there waiting for us in the middle of nowhere there when we got to the border. And yes, lo and behold, they were there. So we were able to go ahead and move in up there in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Where were you waiting for the paperwork to come through? Were you waiting in Madison or somewhere else?
No, actually, no. I had given up my studio. This is like a really sad, it's almost like a cartoon. This is almost kind of a sad story. We'd given up our apartment. I'd given up my studio. I had just loaded everything into the U-Haul truck and pulled the door down. And my wife came down from the apartment and said, they're calling from Winnipeg. And they were saying, and they said, don't come. We don't have the paperwork. It hasn't gone through yet. So we had nowhere to go. We'd already given up our apartment. So I stuck all of my belongings in John Bennett's studio. He had an extra sort of little studio space on University Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And then we drove to my wife's parents' house in Kansas City and stayed there for a couple of weeks until we found out that the paperwork had gone through. And so then we drove back to Madison and picked all of our stuff up in a different U-Haul truck and drove out to Winnipeg. And it went through with no problems, but it was a kind of a rocky start to this little adventure going to Canada.
Yeah. How did your wife feel about that too? I mean, how did both of you feel? But what was her situation as well? Like with a, I don't know, was she working or was she?
She technically wasn't able to do any work in Canada. I was the only one who had a work visa.
Okay.
And so she did some babysitting at home, kind of under the table.
Mm-hmm.
For we were only there for 2 years. And I was only technically allowed to work for the University of Manitoba. I did teach a couple of workshops at the local museum, but I couldn't even just go get a job at a McDonald's or deliver pizzas or anything like that, technically. So it was 2 years of me working at the university teaching relief print, and I taught a book arts class, and they had actually a pretty nice letterpress shop with a Vander Cook proofing press, and it was all set up. I could just walk in and start printing and start teaching that class there. And then the second year, the etching instructor, Arnold Sinker, went on sabbatical, and so I took over his etching classes and taught full-time. I was part-time the first year and full-time the second year.
Okay.
Amazingly, they gave me this whole house as a studio. It's kind of a house that was right on the edge of campus. And so I was able to, a friend had a press that she wasn't using, and so I was able to install that, and it was just an etching press in this house. And I worked out of that studio and did mostly etchings at that period. One of the last pieces I did in Madison was I invented this sort of mythological character named Mr. Fox.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Fox sort of, my wife came home one day and was talking about, she's an education major and taught school before we got married, elementary school. And she was talking about a children's game called What Time Is It, Mr. Fox, which is kind of a blind man's bluff sort of game. And I kind of thought about that phrase, What Time Is It, Mr. Fox, and thought it was kind of mysterious and poetic. Who is Mr. Fox and why are we asking him what time it is? And so I invented this character that has to do with time. And over the years, I sort of embellished it and became, kind of grew in my mind as what he was all about. But basically, when I talk about him, I usually say that when I go into the studio, you know, it's like 9 o'clock in the morning. And when all of a sudden I turn around, it's 5 o'clock. Well, Mr. Fox has been at work. Steals my time away from me. And there's studio time, and then there's time in the rest of the world. And they're not the same thing. And it all had to do with Mr. Fox. So one of the books that I did a series of prints when I was at University of Manitoba and living in Winnipeg. But I did this book called Stitching Time, which was the first book I did after I got out of school. And it's all about Mr. Fox. It's a book of etchings that are printed bleed, so they stand off all the edges and have text printed onto the images in some cases. And in other cases, they have transparent or translucent rice paper pages. So I was trying to kind of use the time-based format of the book to get at the idea of time. Can sort of see through some of the pages, looking into the future, and as you page through the book, just like any book, you start to stack up the past over on the left-hand side, and I like the idea of being able to sort of see into the future and have that sort of sense of time as something that's built into the format. So that book was printed in 1981, I think.
I think I have it 1982, maybe. Yeah. Does that sound right?
Well, I think it's actually 81 when I actually did the printing of it.
Okay.
And it's actually one of my favorite books because it's sort of like I say, the time-based medium of the book format is sort of inherent to the idea of the book.
Jim, you're talking about etching reminds me that I wanted to ask you, last time you mentioned that you wanted to go to Madison because Warrington Colescott was teaching and then he was on sabbatical. Did you ever end up getting to take a class with him?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
He came back my second year and okay. I took a couple of classes with him. And, he certainly was a mentor and was, I learned an awful lot of interesting technical things from Warrington, as well as just the sense of sort of being a print artist. We were all sort of in awe of Warrington. And he would have us come out to his farm, his studio outside of town, and just his layout and how he operated with, he was, you know, married to Fran Myers, and she's a wonderful artist and print artist in her own right, but she also did a lot of printing for him, and they collaborated together on his work. And it was such a wonderful lifestyle that he embodied that that was probably one of the major things that I remember and got from working with Warrington. I actually had Warrington come up to University of Wisconsin my second year as a visiting artist. Everybody was equally impressed when he came up there.
Oh, where did he come?
Yeah, up to the University of Manitoba.
Okay. Oh, okay, interesting.
I had him come up as a visiting artist up there.
And what was it like having him there? Like, did you kind of show him around or...?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And, there were various social gatherings and as well as his lectures. And I think he did some kind of a little demonstration sort of thing, but it was mostly him sort of discussing his work with the students. And you know, I had prepped them really well because, you know, again, I had just come from there, and so I was full of stories and enthusiasm at the time for Warrington. And so when he was there, they were all primed for him coming.
Mm-hmm. And what were your students like there? I mean, how many students were studying? I mean, you said you were teaching some book arts classes and mm-hmm. printing. Could you talk a little bit more about the students who were there?
Students were really good. It's a provincial university, and Winnipeg is a really nice city, fairly large city. And the students came from mostly from Manitoba. There were some who came from a little bit further away, like Montreal or in Toronto, but mostly they were people from the area, and they worked really hard. They really cared about their work. They were very conscientious about doing things, and I got on real well with them. And I taught silkscreen too.
Okay.
I think that's mainly what I was hired to teach relief and silkscreen the first year, and then I taught, in addition to those, I taught intaglio in the second year, and then I forget which year I did the book arts class. I only taught it once. It must have been the second year because I was full time the second year. Probably that's what it was. There was one student in particular who did just amazing books with me, and he went on to do a lot of photo graveur, and he moved out to St. John's in Newfoundland, and he was a little bit older, and so it was kind of nice having him in the classes too.
Mm-hmm. And were you teaching undergraduate students?
Yes. There might have been a graduate program, but I don't think there was. I certainly didn't have any graduate students.
Okay. And how did you adjust to life in Manitoba? I mean, you had kind of a tricky start getting there, but what did you think of it while you were there?
Oh, that's great. I mean, it's the first time I'd lived outside of the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
and even though it was in Canada, there was still sort of a Midwest feel to it,
mm-hmm.
sort of directly north of sort of the Midwest, and so there is the same sort of attitude, I think, in people's minds, and they're just... sometimes I felt a little cut off from things that were going on in the U.S. And one of the things that was an issue, I understand why, but I was not able to apply for grants and things that there's this wonderful series of Canada Council grants that people all around me were getting, but I wasn't eligible to apply because I wasn't a Canadian citizen. And didn't have landed immigrant status or anything like that, so I wasn't able to. There were things I just wasn't able to, opportunities I wasn't able to get a hold of. And after a couple of years, it seemed like it was probably time to look for a job back in the States, just because I sort of felt like I was a little cut off.
Sure. And how did you start looking for a job in the States?
Applied to jobs through the College Art Association,
mm-hmm.
and went to the conference, and applied to a number of different places. The conference was in New York City, and I applied to, a number of places, but I got a couple of interviews, one of which was at the University of Hartford. Talked to people there at the conference interviews, and they said, you know, we really like you, but we would like you to do a second interview and come see the school, but there's no way we can fly you all the way out from Winnipeg. So they said, if you're interested in doing this, you should get on a train and come up to Hartford from New York, because we probably wouldn't be able to fly you out. So I rearranged my schedule and did that.
Mm-hmm.
And they toured me around, and I met a bunch more people and showed my work. That book that I made, Stitch in Time, seemed to have a big impact on people, and I think they were at Hartford, and they were kind of looking for somebody to sort of start doing some book arts things. There wasn't anything like that here at all at the time. And Fred Weffel was the printmaker. I interviewed with him and a couple of other faculty members, and he was also kind of impressed that I'd gone to the University of Wisconsin and worked with Warrington and with Walter Hamady and had that sort of pedigree.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sort of had a lot to do with them being interested in me.
So then how did that work out? You got the job. And was the job supposed to focus on the book arts a bit, or can you tell me a little bit more about the role, like, initially?
The job was a printmaking position, full-time tenure-track printmaking position. But like I said, there wasn't any book arts courses being taught. So it was basically, I was being hired to teach etching and silkscreen primarily, and then also to teach in the foundations program, teaching drawing. And so after a couple of years, I sort of figured out a way to kind of start teaching book arts, kind of snuck it into the program a little bit, along with some other things that they weren't really teaching yet. And sort of, so that's sort of how that evolved.
I'm sorry, just to clarify, are you talking about Hartford, or are you talking
Hartford?
Yeah, okay.
I'm talking about Hartford.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm curious too to know, you brought your book with you. Were you trying to sell books at all early on?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, anytime I could get a book in front of people, I would try to sell it.
Okay.
And whenever I would take a trip, I usually would try to line up some interviews with rare book dealers or rare book librarians and to show my stuff. I can't remember if I might have done something that on that trip at the New York Public Library. I can't remember now, but.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, almost any time I would go somewhere, I would try to see if I could get somebody interested in what I'm doing.
Sure. And can you tell us a little bit about your move to Hartford then?
Well, so in 1982, in the summer, we moved out here, drove out. And initially, we moved directly to Hartford. Found an apartment and moved in, and I would work. I would do my work, my artwork at the school. I had a back bedroom where I would do drawing and sort of draw on plates and things. But I didn't have any printing equipment at home, so I would go into the school, which was about a mile away, and use the facilities there. And I did, as I was doing in Winnipeg, I did a lot of etching and intaglio work, both. And mostly as single sheet prints. I had sort of really got on a kind of a roll when I was in Canada about working the plates and working them, scraping them out, reworking them, trying to make them as rich as possible. And so this series about Mr. Fox there were single sheet prints as well as the book, and that carried over to some of the first stuff that I did when I came out here to Hartford. And because I was so close to the school, I was able to spend a lot of time in the evenings and on weekends working out of the print shop. But, you know, the more you're there, the more it's harder to sort of separate being the artist from being the teacher.
Sure.
So as time went on, I found it harder and harder to do. I didn't really have a studio at the school. In fact, when I was interviewing, you know, like I said, in Canada, they could give me a whole house as a studio. So when I was interviewing at Hartford, they said, so where's the studios? And they all just kind of looked at each other and laughed, because there were no studios for faculty.
Okay.
At Hartford. And so I was kind of spoiled by what I had in Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just working out of the print shop.
And how did you like teaching at the University of Hartford? How is it different or similar to Manitoba?
Well, it's a little different, I think. It's you know, East Coast attitude is just a little different than Midwest attitude, and I think I had to. I'm kind of soft spoken, I think, probably, and I sort of had to talk louder and faster and more emphatically to get people's attention and to hold their attention. And students didn't seem to just really just want to immediately do what I wanted them to do. It's like I had to sort of talk them into it a little bit sometimes. And so it took, you know, a little bit of a learning curve about that when I got out here. And it still goes on, I think. I still have to sort of force myself to be a little more, sort of push my agenda a little bit more with students than maybe what I used to have to do when I was living in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
But the art school is a wonderful place and has a wonderful history. It dates from 1877. It was a kind of an old art school that was first met in the Wadsworth Athenaeum for a while, museum in Hartford, and went to various locations. And eventually it came together with some other area colleges to form the University of Hartford. But the Hartford Art School is a professional art school within the University of Hartford, and it certainly has the oldest history of any part of the university. And it was a drawing and painting academy for a long time, and eventually different other departments have been added on to it. And it's a full-blown art school, you know, with pretty much everything that most people would want. The printmaking department had has always had a couple of faculty. And like I said, Fred Wessel was the senior faculty. He taught litho and drawing. And then I taught etching and flip screen. And eventually I sort of snuck, for some reason nobody was teaching relief at all. And so I snuck some relief in, first as special topics, and then it became a full-fledged course. And then I snuck the book arts in and started to add that into the curriculum a little at a time. And there was no book arts equipment, no type, no. There was an old press that, number 219 Vandercook Proofing Press, that was being used as a tabletop.
Oh.
And because nobody really wanted to use it for anything. And I eventually traded it for an SP15 that was much, because we didn't really have enough room for this big 219 anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And we used that for a long time. And then eventually I got another Vandercook and I took the SP15 home. I traded it for one I bought. And I took the SP15 home. And I still use that today.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the books that you were making when you first, I guess, moved to Hartford? And I guess the other thing is, how did you balance your... Well, I'll let you answer that first.
First book I did when I was here in Hartford. Let me think about this a second here. I did a series of kind of small scale books, things that I at the time was calling barely a book.
Mm-hmm.
they were kind of like portfolios that it might have some fold out accordion coming out of it, or you would open the portfolio and there would be some pages that were kind of stacked up inside somehow. So I did a book called A Calling Out in 1984 that had a nursery rhyme printed in it on a sewn-in piece of rice paper into this multicolored linoleum cut. These were really small editions, 10, 15 copies, things like that. I did an accordion fold book called Candle in a Storm in 1986 that is kind of, you know, being from Kansas, when I tell people I'm from Kansas, I usually get one of two comments. One is, wow, it's really flat out there. Or it has something to do with the Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
And so this book was sort of had to do with, you know, tornadoes and trying to keep a candle lit in a storm that sort of, in a very tangential way, sort of evolved out of the idea of the Wizard of Oz. My life is kind of like keeping a candle lit in the storm sometimes. And this accordion is kind of a long panoramic image of with this kind of whirlwind line work that came across it. And then also in 86, I did another of these kind of portfolio, barely a book kind of things called Mr. Invisible at Home. And I have a tendency to invent these sort of characters or these mythological figures and kind of play with them a little bit in different ways. So I had invented this guy called Mr. Invisible, who is around all the time, but nobody ever notices. They don't see him. And so this was I had done a couple of prints. I don't know that they were all that great, but eventually I decided to make kind of a book-like thing that had to do with Mr. Invisible, and that was in 86. Do you want me to go on with more about my books, or do you want to talk about collaborations with other people?
It's up to you. What would you like to discuss first?
Well, you know, it might be interesting to talk about some of the collaborations, because they several of them came in this earlier time.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So in 1980 and 1981, while I was still in Winnipeg, Walter Hamady asked me to make some images for his papermaking book. Papermaking A Book of Suspicions, which was a fairly major work about everything he knew about papermaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so he asked me to make images that illustrated some of the technical aspects of papermaking, of molds and deckels and felts, couching, and so I did linoleum cuts, and then he made letterpress blocks based on the linoleum cuts, and I was really excited about doing this, of course, because, you know, working with Walter as a student is one thing, but working with him as a collaborator was a whole other thing. And so I spent a lot of time making quite a number of images, some of which he rejected, some of which he told me, okay, change this, make this a little bit different. And so things went through a lot of permutations. But in the end, I was very excited about his printing this book through his Perishable Press Limited. When it went out to is all over, you know, many, many libraries and collections. And so that was one of the first collaborations that we did with other people.
Jim, were you corresponding over mail or through the mail then, or over the phone, or how did you?
Mostly mail.
Mail.
You know, Walter's a voracious letter writer.
Okay.
He just writes letters constantly. And so, you know, I might get a couple of them in every week. I would send him stuff, and he would quickly dash a letter off back to me. And so I don't know if I ever talked to him on the phone about things or not. I might have, but it was mostly through mail.
Okay.
Then when I moved out here to Connecticut in 1983, Charles Alexander, Black, at the time his press was called Black Mesa Press, asked me to do some illustrations for a book he was doing called Captain Jack's Chaps, or Houston MLA by Edward Dorn. And I made five images. These were drawings, pen drawings that I sent him, that he made letterpress line blocks, commercial line blocks for, printed in this edition. The text is about a modern language association convention in Houston, Texas, and the various panels and different characters that appear at this conference. And so I did these sort of satirical line drawings of like the Hyatt Hotel where the conference took place and different people at different panels. And, they were printed in red, in this kind of rich red. And then Kathy Keene actually helped Chuck Alexander sew that edition.
Okay.
Then in 1986, I did a collaboration with Walter Tisdale, Talon Books. And Walter asked me to illustrate a book by Jesse Glass, Jr., called The Sleeper. And this is one of my favorite things. It's a book that, or a poem, one single poem that is in a kind of a fold-out kind of construction that equates sleep with death. And he just wanted one image, because of the construction of the book, he wanted this central image that would be in the middle as it, this thing folded out. And I could think how to do it in with lots of different images, but I could not come up with just one image that sort of summed up my feelings about this poem. And at the time, we had bought a house in a little town called Newington, Connecticut, just a suburb of Hartford. And I remember being out in the backyard one day, and I was cutting branches down, trimming some trees. And in order to get the trash to take the branches away, you got to bundle them up. Then you can put them by the side of the road, and the trash will take them away. So I was bundling up these branches, and they started to look like arms and legs to me. And I started putting them together in these sort of scarecrow-like effigies and tying them together and just sort of having fun. And it didn't have anything to do with art. It was just sort of something fun to do when I should have been working on trimming these trees. But later on, I started thinking about it, and these sort of stick-like figures sort of started to take on a more importance for me. And eventually I decided to start drawing them. And eventually this stick figure that's made out of bundles of sticks evolved, and that became the image that it was used in The Sleeper. And I like it was done as a linoleum cut that I sent Walter Tisdale, and he printed the linoleum cut. It worked out really well. I like that production a lot. But it also went on to do a whole series of prints and drawings of stick figures, figures made out of bundles of sticks, effigies, and there was about 2 years worth of single sheet prints and drawings based on that same series of stuff that came from that collaboration with Walter Tisdale. In 1992, Barb Tettenbaum, who had taken over the Silver Buckle Press, mm-hmm. being director of Silver Buckle Press there at the Memorial Library. Walter, John Bennett had been the director, and then I think Walter was director for a while, and then Barb took over. She contacted me about being involved in a production that they were doing called A Printer's Exquisite Corpse.
Yes.
Which is an exquisite corpse project where there were, I think, 32, something like that, different artists and each are letterpress printer printmakers. Each artist was assigned a section of the body, the head or the torso or the sort of pelvis, legs, feet section. And we were to produce cards on a certain size that would begin and end at certain points on the figure, and an additional, I think it was 100. And there had to be some letterpress involved in relief, but letterpress somehow too. And I was assigned the head section. And so I thought about it for a while, and eventually I decided to do a portrait head of Sigmund Freud.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured he's messed around with our heads for a long time. I thought maybe I should do the same, you know, for him. So I produced this color reduction woodcut of Sigmund Freud's head that went into this amazingly beautiful box that was constructed by Book Lab down in Austin, Texas, I think, with compartments for each of the cards that line up to produce the figure, and you can mix and match them in any way you want. And there were a whole lot of other really wonderful letterpress artists in there, including a lot of old Wisconsinoids,
mm-hmm.
Dean and Walter Tisdale and Jim Escalante, a lot of people in that portfolio.
Did you trade ideas with anybody, or did you all kind of work on your own and then you just saw everything when it came together?
Yeah, we were, well, I mean, I didn't talk to anybody about it. We mm-hmm. were, in fact, I think that's sort of the premise of the thing, is you don't know what other people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole figure is made out of these images that you don't know what they're going to look like until you see them all together. So it was a real surprise to see what other people had done.
Mm-hmm.
They did one later on called An Exquisite Horse.
Yes.
That was just two panels as opposed to the three horizontal panels. But it was a great little project to be involved in. Then in 1999, Walter Hamady asked me to collaborate with him on a book called Whitman Sampler, printed through his Perishable Press. It's a story by Richard Wiley about a little family in Japan in the late 19th century, when Commodore Perry is trying to sort of open Japan to the rest of the world for trade. And so I did four multi-block color woodcuts in sort of a Japanese ukiyo-e sort of style. And it's really one of my favorite collaborations that I've done with anybody. I like the way it came out. I like what Walter did with it. I like the story a lot. I cut the blocks and proofed them here, and they were, you know, like three or four blocks per image. And then I sent Walter proofs along with the blocks and little recipes for how to mix the inks and draw downs of the ink colors so he could match them.
Mm-hmm.
And after a couple of weeks, I got a package in the mail, and it was a letter that said, I cannot match these colors. And the box was had small quarter-size containers, like quarter-size mason jar containers. It says, you mix the inks, put them in these jars, and send them back to me. So I did, and he used those inks to print the book. The title page is an image of sort of a harbor with a sort of steamship in the harbor, and then there's several other images. And then after he printed the initial images with each of the blocks in place, he started to play around a little bit with the blocks and just print sections of the images in very transparent colors with the text coming down over them. So they become sort of abstract and how the blocks are taken out of context and reused through the back end of the book. And it's just a beautiful production that I was very proud to be involved in with Walter. In 2003, I did another book with Walter Hannity called Depression Dog by Toby Olson. This is a story of people, it's a section of a much larger novel, but it's a story of people kind of uprooted and wandering around during the Depression in the 30s. But it's all seen through the eyes of a dog. And so I did several images based on different parts of the text and sent them to him. They were woodcuts. And in the end, he only used one. I think the other images sort of wound up on the cutting room floor. There were three other artists in that book, though: Heinrich Drescher, Peter Siss, and David McClemens. And so I think it's a really wonderful book. The image they used of mine is a kind of a landscape image, kind of a snowy landscape image that sets the sort of time frame and sets the time of year for the story. Those are pretty much the collaborations I've done with other people.
Sure. Well, speaking of landscapes, some of your other books include Prince of Landscapes, and I wonder, is that something that are you particularly drawn to creating those kinds of prints, or is it more that the work is kind of dictating how you illustrate it?
Well, prior to moving out here to the East Coast, landscape was not on my radar screen at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was just not something I was interested in. But when I moved out here, you know, coming from the Midwest, which has such open sort of space, I felt very claustrophobic here for a number of years. There's just so many trees, just so closed in, you can't see or around the curve on the road, you can't see very far. In the fall, it's beautiful, and when leaves come off the trees, then you could see further, but I just had a very different sense of the land when I moved out of here. But I moved from the west side of Hartford over to the east side, across the Connecticut River, in about 1990, bought a house in this little town called Glastonbury. And so I would drive across the Connecticut River on a couple different bridges almost daily. And that was where I had kind of a long vista. I could see much further, and I would watch the river, and I would watch what was going on along the shoreline through the different seasons. And over the course of a couple of years, I got very interested in the landscape, and I started looking at more landscape art, and started to sort of dabble with things having to do with landscape. And in 93, I took a sabbatical, and the sabbatical project was to drive along the Connecticut River and document various locations and do drawings and work based on the Connecticut River.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent the fall driving up and down the 410-mile length of the Connecticut River from Connecticut all the way to the Canadian border. Connecticut River sort of forms in a series of small ponds and lakes that kind of dribble out of Canada right at the border. And it's a very narrow, you can throw a rock across the Connecticut River very easily up north. And as it flows south, it gets wider and wider and slower. And it kind of forms a sort of liquid spine down the west of New England. It forms the border between New Hampshire and Vermont, and it splits Massachusetts in two, and then more or less splits Connecticut in two. And so I did a series of drawings on site, mostly pastel. pastel had sort of become my color medium. I never considered myself a painter. I don't really feel like I got a very good hold on how paint works. And a brush was never my favorite tool.
Mm-hmm.
But a stick like charcoal or pastel or a pencil or something that has a kind of a hard point has always been my favorite kind of tool. And so pastel became sort of my color medium. And so I just would drive along the river and find some site that I really liked and sit down and draw and spend several hours drawing and then pack it up and drive some more. And over the course of that fall, I just made a whole lot of work about the Connecticut River, which then on extended on into the spring. And by the end of that year, I was pretty enamored with the river and decided that maybe I should do a book that was based on the river.
Mm-hmm.
And these days, I think this is kind of when this started. These days, I do a book when I sort of start to see a series of work coming to an end. It seems like a good way to sum up a series of work.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of start shopping around for art writers and poets that lived in the Connecticut River Valley, and eventually found 8 different writers, 2 from each state that the river flows through, and either asked them to write something about the Connecticut River, or if they already had something written, I would kind of entertain that, and eventually Place of the Long River was the result. I made 14 color woodcuts, or color reduction woodcuts in the book. There's fold outs. There's each of the writer's kind of location is paired with imagery from that area. There's maps on the inside covers, on the inside front cover. There's various locations of where the images come from that are in the book. And on the back cover, the locations of where the writers live are indicated on the map of New England, the Connecticut River Valley. The book was printed in an edition of 100 copies, the biggest production I've ever done before. And it was bound by Barbara Blumenthal in Northampton, Massachusetts, in a kind of a silk, Japanese silk blue cloth with these little strands of orange that kind of look like sunset on the water.
Could you talk a little bit about how the process that you went through to make these color reduction woodcuts?
Just the technical aspect
of
how you do that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I generally make a drawing on the block. A lot of times it already exists on paper and I transfer it onto the block. But
mm-hmm.
I put all of the information I'm ever going to need on the block. It's a very fully drawn image. And I use birch plywood mounted on MDF or to get it up to be type high. The birch plywood is only about 1/4 inch thick, because I don't need it to be any thicker than that. And then after I draw the image with all the line work and all the tones on it, I seal that with shellac.
Mm-hmm.
And any part of the drawing, part of the image that's going to be white, gets cut away, but most of the block is still uncut. And then I ink the block up and print it on all of the sheets I ever intend to print with the lightest color. Let's say it's yellow.
Okay.
Just for the sake of argument. Where I want that yellow to appear in the image, the final image, I then cut those areas away from the block so that when I roll the block up and print it over the top of the first run, the yellow shows through the holes. And I print the next darkest color, usually. Let's say it's pink or something. The yellow is going to show through the holes of the next cut those areas away and roll it up with the next darkest color and print that on all of my sheets. So you, with reduction, you are constantly printing and cutting and printing and cutting. There's no way to proof it all up ahead of time to see what it's going to look like. You have to go on faith that it's going to work, and you print on all the sheets you ever intended to use, because there's no way to go back and print more because you were cutting it away. Mm-hmm. When you're all done, you print the last run, usually in the darkest color. Most of the block is in the trash can at that point. And you're printing just, I'm printing just thin little skinny lines and some dark shadows and small areas. Most of the block is carved away. So there's a destructive quality to the creation of the image, which I kind of enjoy. I like the irony and the poetry of that idea. It's a little bit like walking on a tightrope. You hope you get to the other side, you don't fall off. I like that risk. Before I started doing reduction woodcut, and when I did etchings or when I would do other kinds of relief prints, I would do all the proofing and I would sort of get all my jollies out as I'm working through getting that image to be to a resolved point. Then it just becomes work to crank them off, mm-hmm. print a bunch of copies. That's not very much fun. With reduction, you don't know what you're going to get until you're all done printing. When you put that last run on and you see the magic of that thing all come together, it's amazing. And you're all done printing. You don't have to go back and crank off a bunch of copies after the fact. So my editions, before I started doing reduction printing, were kind of small because I just would get bored with printing them. Mm-hmm. Work. Once I started doing a reduction, my editions got bigger because I wanted to make sure I would have enough copies for all of the work that I was going through. I would be printing the edition as I was conceiving and developing the image. My sheets go through both books and single sheet prints, go through the press routinely 12 to 15 times to maybe more, 20 times, to produce the kind of lush layers of color and color relationships that I'm looking for. And as time has gone on, they've become more and more kind of watercolor-like, with layers, very translucent layers of ink with lots of transparent base in them, so that I'm getting very subtle gradations and subtle color relationships that come from the way that I print the blocks. I do a lot of color blends, and I use a lot of stencils to localize colors in different areas. And I spent a lot of time printing these things, but like I said, in the end, the edition is done when the image is finished. So it's a wonderful way that kind of works out.
And how do you choose the colors? Were you, for Place of the Long River, looking back at your work in pastels, or was this just very different in terms of the colors that you were choosing?
I was looking at my pastels. The thing is, the coloration of pastel is so totally different. It's kind of dry and, mm-hmm. and chalky compared to what I'm doing in relief print. And so there's always a translation, mm-hmm. which is kind of good. You know, it's something new. I don't like the idea of sort of reproducing things, something that already exists somehow, just making a bunch of more copies of it. I like everything to be something new. So there's always a translation from the pastel drawings to the color woodcuts. And I'm still having to kind of figure it out. It's not just this color on the drawing goes here on the print. It's really like something new, and the color relationships are kind of intuitive. I lay down some colors. Oftentimes I'll lay down some color blends in the sky and in the water maybe, and then start building on top of some of those color blend relationships with other kind of colors, and working always from light to dark and it's almost always, you can always make it darker. It's very hard to make it lighter if it gets too dark. So I always try to work in that direction. And eventually, like I said, they become more or less like watercolor paintings.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never done watercolor. So it was a kind of a weird thing. Recently, I started doing watercolor, and because I just sort of felt like, you know, making these prints, and they look a certain way, why can't I do it directly onto paper? So I started doing that.
And how do you like that?
I like it. I'm not a very classically trained kind of watercolor artist. You know, I'm not a purist by any means. And I just do whatever I got to do. I use a lot of gouache, and I draw back onto the sheets. But it's close to painting as I've ever gotten. And so I enjoy it. I enjoy the kind of quick aspect of it, because so much of my work takes so long to produce. And this is a way of kind of getting something that's, the results are a lot quicker. I draw all the time, though. Everything I do has a basis in drawing, whether it's pencil drawings or charcoal or pastel, I even consider these watercolors more or less as drawings because of the way that I kind of work.
Mm-hmm. And did you take any color theory courses, or did you just kind of develop your sense of the relationships through other courses?
Well, I had a sort of typical color class that, most art students have, and I did color wheels and color stripes, and learned the theory of it. But so a lot of times that stuff doesn't help you much when you're in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Complementary colors, I think, and value are probably the two major things about color that I respond to. Complementary colors hype each other up when they sit next to each other. They calm each other down when they're mixed together. They gray each other out. So I use that idea of complementary colors a lot in the way that I use color. And then I think in terms of value, because I'm constantly adding transparent base to my inks, I start with very thin layers. So a lot of the white of the paper shows through. The light goes through the ink and bounces back to your eye like it does in watercolor. So, when people print, a lot of times people print relief really thick and opaque. And I tend to go the other direction. I tend to make things very thin and transparent and trying to get them to drop down into the paper and slowly build it up. So that's probably why my prints take so long to make. I make such sort of subtle jumps and subtle changes, but it's the way that I sort of work in order to get the kind of results that I'm after. I oftentimes will do a pencil drawing in just black and white to kind of work out basic value structures.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very interested, very cognizant of composition, how composition works in the space, how the space is framed up and where shapes are and how they work sort of abstractly. And I work that all out first as pencil drawings. I don't really think too much about the color. I think about how the value relationships work. Then eventually that kind of morphs into color as I start to get into making the print.
Oh, thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
Would you like to talk about some of your other books?
Yeah.
I know, let's see, Lonesome Rose, I know we have at UW-Madison. Did you want to talk a little bit about that one?
Maybe before I talk about that one, I'll mention another, I'm not sure if you have this book. Yeah, no, you don't. It's a book called Trouble Light.
Mm-hmm.
This is a large accordion fold book I produced in 1989, and it's a linoleum cut book. It is 15 and a quarter inches tall, and it opens out to 88 inches long, so it's a pretty long, big book. And it came from a series of work that I was doing about light, both light in terms of visual light and how it works in a space and illuminates things, but also poetically and more sort of philosophically or mystically what light is about. And so it's a lot of symbolic imagery in it, the different kinds of forms of light. And it moves from left to right along the accordion fold sort of panorama with various images sort of spliced together to create this kind of journey that takes place. And it goes through various locations that have different kinds of light in them. There's two snatches of nursery rhymes carved into the blocks that appear in the book. And in the end, it ends with a large beehive. And both the idea of light and the idea of beehives were symbolic imagery that I'd been working with quite a bit in that period in the late 80s in drawings and other prints. And it kind of coalesced into this book called Trouble Light. The term Trouble Light comes from my father. He was an aeronautical engineer, but he was also an amazing auto mechanic and just an incredibly handy guy. And a lot of times he would have me come out into the garage at night while he's working on a car, and he would say, "Here, hold this Trouble Light. Hold it over the hood so I can see what I'm doing." And, you know, a trouble light is like a utility light with a little cage on it so you don't burn yourself with the bulb. And it has a little hook on it that you can hook it up under the hood so you can see what you're doing. And there's just other people just, I don't know if they use that term or not, but he always called it a trouble light. And years later, I used to think about that phrase and thought it was a kind of a strange poetic term, trouble light. What happens when we turn on a trouble light? Does trouble vanish the way that the dark vanishes? Or does it attract trouble the way a yard light attracts bugs in the summer at night? I just like the poetry of that term, and so that's how that book came about. And like I say, it came out of a series of work that had to do with light. Then Alchemical Lion, you have that, I think. Yeah. That's a book by Jesse Glass. It's a poem about a kind of a mystical lion. And I was at a fellowship from the Brandywine Workshop in Philadelphia. They bring artists in to produce prints in their workshop using hand-drawn mylars printed on their rotary offset presses. So they're hand-drawn, but then those mylars are shot onto photo litho plates. And it's usually a fairly sort of rote way they do it. You draw up a yellow mylar, and you do a red mylar, a blue mylar, and a black mylar, and you're there for a week, and they print one color a day. I decided to do a book, which kind of threw them for a loop, because they'd never produced a book before. And so what I did was they would work routinely on a sheet of 22 by 30 Arches paper. And what I did was I drew the image up so that it was still printed on that size sheet, but it was two strips that would be cut horizontally down the middle, and then joined together to create the long accordion fold. And so I drew the mylars up at home. They'd send you all the materials and tell you exactly how to do it. So you come to Philadelphia to the workshop with the stuff ready to print so they can get going right away. So I drew them all up, and I had them in a tube, and I went there, and they printed the first color. It was going to be a yellow, and I'm looking at the Pantone book, and the director is saying, "Here, you should probably use this color. This is the best. Use this yellow." I think, "Oh man, that's so bright. This is like day glow yellow. No, no, no. This is the color. You should use this." So I said, "Well, all right." So they ran 100 sheets with this yellow, and as soon as I saw it, oh, God, oh, no, can't stomach this yellow. So I spent the rest of the week trying to keep ahead of the printer by and redrawing each of the Mylars to cancel out the yellow, to not get back. So I'd be there all night long trying to get these Mylars drawn up so that the first thing in the morning when the printer would come, he could shoot them onto the plate to run the next color. So in the end, it worked out. It doesn't look like anything I've ever done before, but it did require a lot of extra time to get these things to work. We split the edition in half. They kept their 50 copies, and I brought mine home. And I worked a little bit more on mine with some SoString to try to kind of push it around to get it the way I wanted it. And then I did a binding, just hard covers on either end with a two-color image on the cover. Later on, the Brandywine Workshop wanted to bind their copies, and so I ran them some covers and sent them. I didn't want to do the binding, so I sent them the covers, and I think some students from the University of the Arts did the binding under Mary Phelan's auspices there.
Okay.
She taught at University of the Arts, another Wisconsin student, an alum that I overlapped with there in Madison. And so that book, like I say, doesn't look like anything I've ever done before, but it's it worked out in an interesting way. In 1992, I ran The Immigrants. This is a poem by Joe Napura. It's a single poem about his father's immigrant family. I think they're from Hungary. And the whole poem is based on an old photograph of his father's family after they had immigrated to this country. And it addresses the different people in the poem, in the photo, and what kind of happened to them. And so I used the photo as the basis for my imagery, and I had a letterpress halftone block made to put on of the photo to put on the title page. And then I just worked with that photo in different ways, editing, cropping it, and working with different aspects of the different figures all through the book. It's kind of a small pamphlet, paper cover book, but it has woodcut and relief etching, and a fold-out color reduction woodcut, and then a kind of a built-up additive block at the back, has a little photo engraving, letterpress engraving on the cover of a kind of a stitching tapestry kind of thing from the Hungarian kind of culture that appears on the title page too.
And Jim, how did you end up working on this project? I know last time you mentioned you hadn't really done work with poets on your first couple of books?
Yeah, well, both the Alchemical Lion and Immigrants were, I was going out looking for people to work with, trying to come up with some editions that were publishing people's work, because I had not done things with other collaborations with writers or other people. And so these were definite stabs at publishing other people's work. I also, in 88 and 89, did a series of broadsides. I got a grant from the Kinetic Commission on the Arts, and I produced 5 broadsides publishing different poets' work. Jesse Glass and Joe Napora both had, I did poems of theirs on a broadside, and I did a broadside with Ted Enslin, and another with the local Connecticut poet Brendan Galvin, and another one with another Connecticut poet named Franz Dowski. And so that was actually some of the kind of my first forays into working with writers, and then these two books kind of evolved out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the place of the Long River in 93, you know, that's where I really had, I had 8 different writers that I was working with on that particular book.
And you mentioned that that process took a long time. How long did it take to make the 100 copies of that book?
Of which book?
Of Place of the Long River, excuse me.
Oh, it was about 2 years.
Yeah.
I would say it was about most of 2 years. It might have taken a little bit longer for the actual binding to get done before it was actually issued, but mm-hmm. my work on it was about 2 years. And then out of, after the Place of the Long River and the kind of landscape work that kind of led up to that, I pretty much was at that point fully immersed in the landscape. That was sort of where that was the direction I just took. So all of my single sheet print work and drawings have been focused basically on landscape since then. And then Lonesome Rose, which you have there, it came out of that work in 1999. Glastonbury and South Glastonbury had a lot of orchards and agricultural spaces, and I would just go down and draw on the orchards, and I love the way that apple orchards and peach orchards are sort of set up with kind of long rows of trees kind of traveling over the landscape. And especially apple orchards, they prune the trees so severely and specifically to sort of maximize the yield, but they're these strange sort of skeletal-like forms once they do that. And so I would sit and draw these things and create these landscape spaces that are natural spaces, but they're sort of man-made spaces because of the way these rows travel over the landscape. Out of a series of drawings that I'd done, then I produced this book called Lonesome Rose. And again, it was sort of when I started to see this series of work kind of coming to an end. So I thought, well, okay, it's time to make a book and sort of sum up what I've been thinking about. So Lonesome Rose is another accordion fold book that has various images of orchard spaces sort of spliced together. It's panoramic in the sense that it opens out and is a continuous flow of imagery, but each panel is somewhat different than the one next door. It's not a continuous image, but they adjoin each other, abut each other, and compositionally connect, but they're different spaces. And some are plowed fields and some are orchard rows. And it opens up to about 5 feet long. And on the back side of the accordion, it's sort of an abstract echo of what's on the front side. It's a little more intuitive and a little more abstract expressionist in the way they approach the back side. It has some of the same kind of mark making and some of the same coloration, but is sort of non-representational. It's just sort of an abstraction of some of what I was thinking about on the front side. The book was printed from 2 long birch blocks on our flatbed offset press at the Hartford Art School, which has a large format, so I could print like 38 inches across. Okay. And it's their color reduction woodcuts, so they're printed many, many, many times. And that was an edition of 30. It has no text in it. It has a colophon printed on the back of the back cover, and a image on the cover, but there's no text inside.
Did you want to add anything about that book?
I think that's pretty much it about Lonesome Rose. In 2003, I did another sabbatical, and I went to Nova Scotia in northern Maine and New Brunswick and hung out for a while and drew and photographed and spent a bunch of time along the coast of Cape Breton, the northern part of Nova Scotia. And I really like the idea of the various people who've lived in Nova Scotia. The Mi'kmaq Indians, Native people that lived there before us Europeans came, but then the Scots and the English and the Irish and the French Acadians. And so it's a whole mixture of different kinds of people who have lived there over the years. But out of going there and kind of trying to assimilate some of the culture and, of course, the landscape and the sense of place, I became most interested in the Mi'kmaq Native people that first inhabited Nova Scotia and the Brunswick area, Atlantic Canada. And so when I came home, I did a series of prints just about Nova Scotia and about, sort of based on the drawings that I was doing there. But eventually I decided I wanted to do a book about that area, and there were so many different ways I could have gone, and in the end I decided to focus on the Mi'kmaq Native peoples. And so I sort of shopped around tried a lot of different approaches to it. In the end, I hit on working with an ethnologist, the head ethnologist at the Nova Scotia Museum of History in Halifax, Ruth Holmes Whitehead. And she's like the material culture go-to person for Mi'kmaq culture.
Okay.
She's written many wonderful books about the Mi'kmaq people, and she let me excerpt stuff from three of her books. One is a creation story about Glooskap, the Algonquin cultural hero, and how he sort of got the world going. And another story in there is about the turtle and how the turtle got his wrinkled skin. The Mi'kmaq world has a lot of shape-shifting, and people are human beings, and then they're animals, and then they're rocks, and then they're stars. They constantly change and morph into different forms. And the largest section of this book is a story of Mi'kmaq women that marry star husbands. They're sort of abducted by two sisters. They're abducted by these stars. They're taken up to the world above the sky. And initially they're happy about the idea, but eventually they want to come back to the earth world. And the story is about how the various things they have to do in order to come back to the earth world. There's a lot of animals in it, and the texts are embedded into the imagery. It's a horizontal format book called A Duklahan, which is Mi'kmaq for story or tale. And the text are overlapping the imagery, and you see some of the imagery through the text. So I was constantly having to balance the opacity of the imagery together with the text. It's pretty text heavy, but each page has full bleed color reduction woodcuts in it. There's just a tremendous amount of printing in this book. The inside covers have Mi'kmaq porcupine quill designs printed on the front back cover in sheets. I got permission to reproduce Mi'kmaq petroglyphs from the Nova Scotia area. I would redraw them and cut them as wood blocks. So they appear together with my original pictorial color woodcuts. There's, let's see, 23 page surfaces in the book. It's a horizontal format. It opens to, I can't remember now. about 9 by 13, I think, horizontally, closed. And once I finally finished the printing, it took 4 years to print the book.
Okay.
In an edition of 100 copies. So when I was finally done printing, I did not want to do the binding. So I was ready to turn it over to somebody. So I had Sarah Creighton, book binder from East Hampton, Massachusetts, do the binding. She did a beautiful three-part binding with a kind of a red spine. And then my printed color images on the front back covers. On the front, it's a porcupine quill, double curve design, which is a classic Micmac Indian design. And on the backside, it's kind of abstract, but it's basically the map of Nova Scotia on the backside. And it's all is printed in such a way that it looks like birch bark on the front and back covers.
And did I understand you correctly that you said you were working on the text at the same time as the illustrations?
Well, I gathered the text from Ruth Whitehead, and I did a little bit of editing that she let me kind of tinker a little bit with some of the lengths of things, but it's basically her writing.
But I mean when you were printing?
Oh, yeah, you know, I set the type, yeah, and printed, and I would have to do the entire image first and then drop the letterpress over the top.
Okay, got it.
So, again, there's a certain amount of risk there. I'd spend, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks making an image. And at the very end, I would have to drop the letterpress over the top and hope everything looked good. It just comes with the territory, but the text is... I would hope that the text would sit up on top of the image and be able to be legible, and you never quite know until you do it how it's going to work out. So I had to make sure I sort of go on faith that I was leaving a space that was calm enough, simple enough that the text would sit up on top and work well, and I think it did.
And did you do those one at a time or a few at a time to kind of see how that was working? So that, I'm just curious if you like did a few of the illustrations and then worked with the text on a few and kind of played with it that way?
Yeah, I would generally do a whole page spread.
Okay.
And then, so I get the image, you know, in a codex, you know, some of the images on one sheet of paper and it with gathered folios, some on the right hand side on another piece of paper. And so I would get the left hand side working up, and then I'd work the right hand side and kind of work back and forth between those two until the image looked good as it goes across the two pages. And then I would drop the text on them, and I would do the text on that spread, and then I would go on to the next spread and start from scratch again, work the image up, and then eventually put the text on it. So, yeah, the text would go on when the image was done, but not before the next image would be done.
Okay.
And it was a long process. You know, 4 years on one particular thing. I mean, every now and then I'd stop and do a little something else, but generally it's my single sheet print production and production of everything else just kind of came to a halt while I was working on this book. And then since then I've not done anything nearly as complicated and time consuming.
Do you sometimes work with assistants?
Never have. Well, occasionally I might have a student down at the school if I happen to be working at the school for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
I've had some students kind of help me out a little bit down there, but nothing other than that. And I guess it's because I tend to be kind of, mercurial about how I work, and I'm not sure that I would feel comfortable having other people around while I'm trying to make decisions, and sometimes I do something and I don't like it, so I can go back and redo it in a different way, and I would just, I think I'd have a hard time doing that with an assistant sort of standing around waiting to, well, what do I do now?
You know? Sure.
So, you know, a lot of times I wish I could do that. I wish I could, I had the financial means to hire somebody to help me do stuff, or that I could get a grant or something to help create, you know, do some assistant funding, but it's never really worked out. And at this point in my life, I'm probably not sure how well I would be able to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that you haven't done stuff as complicated recently. Can you talk a little bit about your more recent work?
Well, my most recent book was done in 2014. And 2013, I took another sabbatical, which seems to be the way I work. Every 10 years, I do a sabbatical.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of every 7 years, it seems like it's every 10 years. And in 2013, I went to Ireland for 6 weeks. And I was on a residency in County Mayo in the northwest of Ireland at the Ballinglen Art Foundation. And they give you a cottage to live in and a studio to work in, and then just turn you loose to do whatever you want. And so I roamed around the countryside in the west of Ireland and took photographs and did drawings. I didn't do any printing while I was there because I didn't feel I had enough time. I just wanted to gather visual information. And I love Ireland. And I've always loved the idea of Ireland, and it's been a goal of mine to get there for a substantial amount of time, for a long time. And so when I was there, I came home with a lot of drawings, and that led to a series of prints that I'm still working on, prints and drawings, and that's where I started doing watercolor, actually.
Okay.
I figured I'm out of my element, I'm in a different country, a totally different place, maybe I'll try something different. And pastel, I was also worried about making a lot of pastel drawings and then having them get all smudged and smeared up before I get them home, because they're kind of fragile. So I thought, well, maybe a watercolor would be a solution to that. So I started doing watercolor and sort of found my way with it. And so when I came home, I continued to do it for a while. And then in 2014, I had to do before that, I was commissioned to do a print in a portfolio by Diane Fine,
mm-hmm.
another Wisconsin alum who teaches at SUNY Plattsburgh, and she was doing a portfolio with a variety of print artists called How Do You Get There From Here? And the idea was a triptych. You had to come up with a three panel sort of an image, and it came up just before I was ready to go to Ireland, so it seemed like a perfect subject. So the first panel I did before I went, which was sort of about getting ready to go to Ireland, some sort of symbolic kind of stuff that was in that first panel. And the middle panel is sort of, it's kind of really the Aurora Borealis kind of shows up in there with some other things. And then the third panel is a Neolithic passage tomb, stone passage tomb from North Mayo, with a teacup floating over it. So that print was done for this portfolio, but I had a lot of copies left over, and some of them. Invariably, I have copies that don't make it into the edition. They just don't, they aren't good enough.
Mm-hmm. There's
some slight misregistrations, or I change my mind about the colors, or whatever. So I had all these proofs left over. And I have lots of proofs of other projects sitting around that I just can't bear to part with. And I have a lot of blocks from other projects that I can't bear to part with. They're either the last run of a reduction print, but there's still a lot of good stuff left on them. I just got racks and racks of that stuff. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to put all this stuff together, make a little mulligan stew of a bunch of stuff from various projects. And so this book came out of it called Ragged Remains. And there's only 7 copies. It's a codex, hardcover codex, with paper over boards. And there's a section from a Dugwahin book of a whole spread that just didn't work out. I had to totally abandon one of the spreads and redo it. And I had all these sheets that just never got used. So I cropped parts of that, and that became part of the cover paper for this Ragged Remains book. And then as you open the book, there's an accordion strip that pulls out. And on one side is sections of the image from this How Do You Get There From Here portfolio image, but also some other stuff I've printed over the top of it from old blocks that I have kicking around. And on the back side of the accordion is a stone wall from the Burren region of Western Ireland, which is just an amazing region of just huge slabs of limestone all over the landscape. Everywhere you look, it's almost like it's been paved with these huge slabs of limestone. And the farmers dig that stuff up, and they make these incredibly beautiful, abstract, erratic stone walls that border their land. And I would see these, I mean, it's all over that way, all over Ireland, but the ones in the Burren are just especially amazing. And so I did this color reduction woodcut of a extremely abstract stone wall on the backside of that accordion. So it's a kind of a book about the leftover things and reusing them and recycling them and putting them together in new ways, just like the farmers reuse the slabs of rock to make stone walls. I reuse old blocks and old sheets to make this book.
Mm-hmm. Would you care to add anything about how, I mean, I think we've talked a lot about, or you've talked a lot about how you've done each of your books. How would you kind of, looking back, say that your books have evolved?
Well, I think, like I said, I think that initially they were sort of, my first books were sort of canned. You know, I found a set of ideas like nursery rhymes that already exist, or the 7 deadly sins that already exist, a set of things that I would just sort of riff on and play with. And then I sort of started to find my own sort of voice about things, which is almost always somewhat of some kind of a personal mythology of invention of things that relate to who I, everything I do is sort of autobiographical, whether it's obvious or not, it's sort of about me. Most artists, I think, really, their work really is about them at one level or another.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the work that I was doing early in the 80s and 90s was about me in various ways, kind of superimposing these kind of mythological inventions of fictions onto me and onto my story. And then, like I was saying, I made a concerted effort to try doing some publishing of other people's work and collaborating and working with other people and trying to sort of bounce off of what their ideas. And I think that sometimes that works better than other times. It's a process, and those things always take longer because you got to make sure that the collaborations work and make sense, and got to give the other person space to make that work. When I do the things that are my own, I can make my own decisions and make them really quick, to do things that are that I'm just personally interested in, and I don't have to ask anybody else's opinion or make sure that it's going to work for anybody else. And like I said, I think as time has gone on, the space between the books has increased because I'm doing a lot of single sheet prints and drawings in long series of maybe 4 or 5 or more years. And then in the end, when I start to see that sort of coming to an end, that seems like it's time to make a book. So I'm an occasional book artist. It's not something I do all the time. It's not my primary studio practice. It's a one feature of my studio practice. And it, like I say, I think it's a way of kind of summing things up and putting the period at the end of the sentence.
Do you think you'll continue to make artist books then?
I will, but I think that the edition sizes will probably be smaller, just so I can get them done quicker. And they may be less complicated, but if something comes along where I, you know, run across a story or a particular writer or poet or a particular idea that needs some bigger production, you know, I'm not going to shy away from it, but I just kind of like to get more work out there and not have it take quite as long to produce, because it takes long enough as it is for me to do anything.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add before we talk a bit about your teaching?
No, I think that's probably it.
Okay, good. So you've been teaching for how long at the University of Hartford now?
I have been there for 35 years.
Okay, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Since 1982.
And how would you say you have approached teaching over the years? I know before we started recording, you mentioned that initially you're just kind of getting your bearings, but now that you've been teaching for a while, how would you say you approach teaching?
Well, I have three, I would say, major things that I like to try to get across to people no matter what I'm teaching. Drawing is probably fundamental to everything that I do. Mark making, tonality, building up the surface, working the surface. If it's a drawing, if it's a print, if it's in a book format, drawing almost always is a kind of fundamental thing that I want to try to get people involved in. Some people are not interested in drawing, and then so we have to kind of negotiate how this is going to work. There may be photographers or more typographically oriented or something. So maybe drawing doesn't come as naturally to them as other students. But I sort of see everything as a drawing in one way or another. And value, tonality, how the value relationships work is something that I'm also very concerned about and getting across to students. I teach foundations drawing every semester to freshmen. And so value is a major, major component of what I talk to them about. And then composition, how the space is designed, whether it's a drawing or it's a print, or if it's a more complicated multi-plane surface, like a book format, how you compose and activate that space is the other major thing that I care about. I don't care what the subject is, what the technique is, or the style. Those are other issues, but everybody makes a composition when they go to start, they put a pencil down on a piece of paper or something, and you got to activate that space and think about how that space works, wall to wall, from one side to the other. And whether you use it all or not, you still have to think about it. And so I try to infuse those ideas in everything that I'm doing. In my relief print class, I want to get people involved in how the light and darks work in a relief print, but I tell them, you got black already. If you roll the block up in black, everything is already there black. It's easy to make white. You just hack away at the wood or the linoleum. It's those middle values in between the black and the white, those polar opposites, and how you can bring them together with intermediate values that I think really have a lot to do with how successful a relief print is. And so I like to infuse them with the idea of creating different kind of mark making systems, hatchings and stippling and linear activity that creates optical grays or middle values if it's a color print that can work between those extremely dark uncut areas and the bright carved away whites that can make that subtle inner relationships between those opposites work. In paleo and in etching, I'm also interested in them really working the plate. And probably in paleo is the most difficult course that I teach because it's slow. And increasingly, students have shorter and shorter attention spans. So when it doesn't happen right away, like the click of a mouse or the swipe of their finger across a screen, cell phone screen, they get impatient. And the whole idea of etching, anyway, is about time. Time is part of the tool in your toolkit. How long you bite the plate for, how long it sits in the acid. That's a major component of the process. And it doesn't happen all at one time either. Usually you bite the plate, you proof it, see what it looks like, go back, you work it some more, you proof it again, slowly builds up. And I try to get them to have patience and really wait for that, keep working until it really is resolved. And it's increasingly difficult to get them to want to spend the amount of time that's necessary, but that's my goal, to try to get them to really work the plates and have them be as rich as possible. That only happens over a period of time. And in book arts, I want to try to get them to think about the book format as a space in which they are moving around. They're inhabiting this book space. They're using the, almost like it's a theater or a film in which things happen and come and go and become almost like a film director in the way that they approach the book space. When to have things become very complicated and busy and full, and when to sort of back off and let them become more spare, the pacing of a book, what takes place in a book. It's very complicated and it's very slow to develop. My book arts, when I first started teaching book arts, I taught letterpress, I taught one-of-a-kind books, and I taught an editioned book all in one semester, in a broadside, all in one semester, way too much. So we broke it out into two courses, so that there's book one, which is somebody else teaches, that is unique books and book structures and binding and just the physical building of books. And one-of-a-kind books. And then I teach book arts too, which is letterpress printing and editions of books. And so they already know how to make a book and how that book space works. And I have them do a broadside first, so I can teach them letterpress printing and putting text and image together and just to understand the mechanics of letterpress. And then I have them do a very specific dummy of a book. I try to let them make decisions about concepts and subject matter and what's in the book, but I try to get them to be as concrete in their dummy as possible, in their mock-up, so that mock-up becomes a guideline for how the book is then produced in the edition. Sometimes they have to deviate from that mock-up. Things happen along the way. Decisions get made. Sometimes they start to run out of time, so they simplify things. And in fact, a lot of times in teaching book arts, a lot of what I do is to try to kind of corral them in a little bit. And, I don't think you're going to have time to get this done. Can you simplify this? Is there a way to say this in the same, just as well, but say it in a slightly simpler terms or more succinctly? Is they have grandiose ideas, and sometimes they just don't have time in a semester to get it done. Over the years, I've put together a letterpress shop at the Burford Art School. We have two vendor cooks and a range of letterpress type. I like to get people to do work with things like putting different kinds of materials on MDF board and print that first and lay down different textures and drop type and images on top of that. So I have a bank of different kinds of materials around, old like vinyl wall covering material, and different surfaces, and encourage people to work with different textures. I show them about pressure printing, which is, you know, kind of creating make ready, you know, building plates that are taped to the underside of the paper on the cylinder of a proofing press so that it strikes harder where the surface is slightly raised, so they get these kind of soft, smoky kinds of patterns and textures from pressure printing. I try to work my book arts classes with whatever students already knew how to do. And a lot of times, if they're print majors, they've already done other print processes. And they can bring that into the book arts realm. If they want to do litho, if they want to do etching, they can do that. But a lot of times, they have not yet done very much printmaking, and so I sort of push them towards relief printing because it's the most natural way to get at stuff together with letterpress, using the same kind of press and a lot of the same techniques. And so over the course of a semester, they get one, in Book Arts 2, they get one edition of usually 10 copies done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real rush from the beginning to the end to get it all done. And I think they always underestimate how much time it's going to take. And then about 3 weeks from the end, they sort of, it dawns on them how much more they've got to do, and they really have to hunker down and try to get it, you know, or push themselves to get it finished.
And how many students do you have in a class, typically?
Normally, somewhere between 8 and 10.
Mm-hmm.
The university has gotten kind of sticky about size of classes. They won't run things. Technically, it's always supposed to be 10, but they've let us run it with less. But the past couple of years, they've clamped down on that. And so sometimes I don't have enough people to run a class, or I have to combine a couple of classes together in order to have enough kids to satisfy the university. And we've done some curricular changes recently in the Prim Ed department to combine some standalone courses into bigger classes that have different kinds of media together, just to get enough warm bodies in the room to be able to run the class.
Mm-hmm.
It's become more and more of a challenge, I think, over the years to populate the upper levels of the printmaking classes. We have always got full intro level classes. We run usually 4 intro-level printmaking classes a semester: etching, relief, monotype, and book one, and litho one. And sometimes those things alternate. But getting them to go beyond the first level is always the issue, because then they oftentimes want to go off into illustration or graphic design. They're required to take a printmaking course as part of the curriculum for their sophomore level.
Sure.
We always have really full, exciting intro-level courses with a big mixture of students who have come from different backgrounds with different interests. And the idea of trying to get them excited about printmaking is kind of a challenge, but is what those courses are about. And we always get some that move on up into the junior level and become majors. But like I said, it's getting harder and harder these days to get enough people in the room to run some of these classes. So sometimes that whole business is the challenge.
And Jim, how many classes do you teach a semester?
I teach three studio classes each semester.
Okay.
I always teach a foundations drawing class. In the fall, I usually teach we have a capstone, two senior capstone courses. So in the fall, I teach senior printmaking studio one, and my colleague teaches it in the spring. And then I teach one of the intro level courses usually in the as my third course in the fall. And then in the spring, I teach again a drawing class and usually a different intro level. Well, usually two print courses, two print intro print courses in the spring. But then when I know that I've got enough people to run a book arts two class, I'll do that usually in the spring.
So I wanted to ask you earlier, how do you balance teaching with working on your own projects?
Well, it's the standard problem with teaching. I generally don't teach much during the summer. I used to teach a 6-week class during the summer, and I just stopped doing it. I teach a workshop in Vermont most years at Art New England workshops in Bennington College. That's just a week-long workshop. So I have most of my summers off, and that's when I really hunker down and try to do as much work as I can. I try to stay in the studio. And then during January, I have winter term between the two, fall and spring semester. And sometimes I teach a letterpress class during that, a 2-week class during that month, but I don't always do it. When I do, then I throw a little crimp into what I can get done during the winter break. But usually I have bulk of a month during January, late December and January, that I try to get some work done. But it is a balancing act, and I find as I get older and older that I'm able to do less at night. I used to come home when I was, 24, 25. I'd come home from teaching all day long and spend 6 or 8 hours in the studio. I just can't do that anymore.
Yeah, that's a long day.
Yeah, I'm on a basically a 2-day schedule where I teach from 8:30 in the morning till about 8:30 at night,
Okay.
Mondays and Wednesdays, and then I have Tuesday, Thursday, Friday off, but I almost always have to go in on one of those days for meetings and various other things, so it winds up being about two days off during the week, and I try to use those days as well, but during the academic year, there's committees and there's things that I have to write, and there's just a lot of other stuff that goes on. So I try to have something going all the time. But look, during the academic year, it sits around a lot. A week or two might go by, and I go down to my studio. I have my studio in my basement here in my house, and I'll go down and I'll look at what I was working on 2 weeks ago. I think, what was I doing? What was I going to do next? Where am I? What am I supposed to do now? And I got to sort of gear up again, And so that's really hard. It's the big vacations where I can really get a head of steam up and really get something rolling. That's when I do the majority of my work.
Well, I think we're heading to the end. I just wondered if there were any final thoughts that you had, maybe about how the UW impacted your career as an artist.
Well, it certainly did. It sort of set me on a trajectory to be a print artist. Before I went to undergraduate school, I had no idea what that was, and I sort of learned about printmaking in undergraduate school, but the 2 years before I went to Madison and then the 2 years at Madison really were seminal in forming who I am, I think, as a print artist, the kind of ethic that I have about how the technique and the image should mesh, and one should not kind of overpower the other, that that craft is an important major element, that you can't have concept without beautiful craft, beautiful technique that expands on the idea and gives the concept a home and a place to exist. And that comes right out of the people I work with at UW, from Warrington Colescott and Ray Gluckler and Walter Hannity, especially those three guys, had a really huge impact on how I see myself as an artist, as a person who is a print artist, and how one can fill that role in the world, and how to sort of operate, how to negotiate the world. I think a lot of things have changed since those days, and the ways of operating, ways of being an artist have certainly changed in the 38 years that I've since I went to school. But it was an amazing time that I still look back on fondly and think how lucky I was to be there at that time. I still regularly talk to a lot of the same other people that I went to school with there. We see each other at conferences, and we communicate, we share ideas amongst ourselves. We're a real cadre. There was a name going around, we were the Madison Mafia.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And or the Madison cohort of people, and we've all gone on to become, I think, fairly important print artists, and I feel lucky and honored to be a part of that group. So not sure where I would be if I had not gone to UW what I did.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Jim. This has been very nice.
Well, thank you, Sarah. I really enjoyed thinking about those days and thinking about looking back on my career. Good luck with this project. I look forward to hearing all these various interviews and hearing what other people have to say as well.